This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us as always to talk about politics is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
John, did you call me about doing this show?
Because I
was not told that you called me.
No.
Did you call Betsy Kaplan? Because I don't talk to Betsy Kaplan.
No, I called you.
I just think it's unfortunate that I wasn't told that you called me, because I could have been much better prepared.
Well, throwing Betsy Kaplan under the bus, a nice way to start a Wednesday morning. I also want to welcome Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com. Hello there, Christine.
Good morning, John.
And Mark Pazniokas, he's Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror. Hello there, Paz.
I always love visiting Crazy Town.
Yeah, I know. Here we are back in Crazy Town. Well, a really interesting night in Massachusetts last night. We're going to start there. Big news as Ayanna Pressley could become the state's first black female elected to Congress, the first in New England, actually, along with potentially Johanna Hayes from here in Connecticut. She ousted 10-term Democratic U.S. Representative Michael Capuano in a Tuesday primary in Massachusetts, just part of a big trend we've seen across America. Here's Pressley from last night's press conference.
So let's make this official, y'all. Are you ready to come to Congress with me? Are you ready to bring change to Washington? Because for the families and victims of senseless gun violence, change can't wait. For our brothers and sisters behind the wall, change can't wait. To our immigrants worried about the knock on the door, change can't wait. To women whose rights are perpetually under attack, change can't wait.
So that's what she's saying last night, what a lot of people across America are saying this morning, Colin. Change can't wait. We heard Asma Khalid from NPR's politics team this morning talking about how she heard Pressley a couple of years ago as a campaigner, and she thought this is someone who can motivate large groups of people and can inspire people to get behind her campaign. She also noted that there was not one single poll that showed that Ayanna Pressley really had a chance of winning, and she won by 18 points last night. So there's a lot of things to pull apart here.
Right. I think we can now say so something's happening, right? I mean, we have enough data points now, whether it's Ocasio-Cortez or what's happened in Florida, Georgia, places like that. There's something going on with progressive candidates, often minority candidates, often women candidates. It's happening again and again compared to Massachusetts last night. And this race, although it's the marquee story, it's not entirely an isolated phenomenon from last night. There were a lot of challengers who won, challengers who challenged people who had leadership positions and leadership associations within the state legislature. Massachusetts is a more restless state, apparently, than Connecticut is. In Connecticut, we kind of don't do this. We don't, for the most part, challenge sitting members of Congress, never mind win challenges against sitting members of Congress. And even if you look at the General Assembly, I'm sure Christine and Paz have a better grasp on this than I do, but there really weren't very many incumbents turned out in primaries on August 14th. Andy Fleischman is the only one I can think of off the top of my head. So, but nationally, something is really happening. And this one kind of resembles Ocasio-Cortez in the sense it's a majority-minority district. She, on the other hand, had been endorsed by both the Boston Globe and the Boston Herald. She, I think, proved her policy chops at that level, too. So, yeah, I mean, this year is already proven that it is a very disruptive year.
And, Christine, this is always a big question. What are we able to pull out from individual races and individual places about a larger movement? Because if you drill down on any of these big wins from insurgent candidates, minority candidates, women candidates this year, there's a slightly different fact pattern. And in one way you're looking at it, there's this huge sweep that Colin's talking about. Another way you're looking at it, there's a lot of individual things happening. So which is it? Which do you see?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see, because I think, when we're talking about the congressional level, I think that the political climate just definitely favors women, political newcomers, and underdogs. But I'm not quite sure if that translates necessarily to the state level. I'm not sure if it would translate to the governor's race, or maybe it would, that the Republican actually in this case is the political newcomer and the underdog, or, say maybe Oz Griebel as the petitioning candidate is the underdog in the race for governor. So there's obviously no women running for governor at the moment. So
no women running for governor in Connecticut, and also has nobody, I think, running for governor or in many of the other races in Connecticut. That kind of sounds a lot like what we just heard. Someone who is clearly able to rally a group of people to her cause in a way that sounds inspiring, new, fresh. Those are all things that we're not necessarily hearing out of Connecticut this time around, save for the Johanna Hayes campaign.
No, that's true. And a couple of thoughts about last night. One, I think we're reminded again of the limits of polling in primaries when there's movement, when there's energy. I think the last poll I saw about her, she was down 13 points, and then she wins by 18. Not a good night for pollsters.
That's a pretty bad night for pollsters.
That's a pretty bad night. But more sympathetically to pollsters, it's really hard to gauge sometimes who's going to show up. Where is that energy? And that is, that will be a question in the 5th District with Johanna Hayes. In many ways, I think Johanna Hayes is a better test case about what is happening out there, to what extent there is a broader appetite for change, for new faces, for somebody who's, of a different race. Because as impressive as Presley's win was last night, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, that was a minority majority district. So, you can't forget that. There is an element of identity politics in that.
And she's also a well-known politician who's been successful in that region before. This is not someone coming from the outside as a former teacher of the year just exploding onto the national scene.
No, exactly. In fact, I'm pretty sure I met her in 2008 at the Democratic National Convention. I was looking for – I do collect business cards, and I do recall running into this Boston city councilor who was a force of nature, and I believe it was her. But in any event, you're right. I mean, she has been involved in politics since she was in college. She was an intern for Joe Kennedy. She's been on the Boston City Council. She was the first black woman on the Boston City Council, she was a great, great campaigner. And so she has an element of the Ocasio-Cortez in that it's a minority majority district, and she sort of caught the attention and the excitement that's out there. But she's also very much a very experienced politician.
When Paz talks about not knowing in a primary, Colin, who's going to show up, especially when you're talking about lower total numbers than you would have in a general election. Maybe the polls as they are traditionally conducted don't work. I did read a little bit of just back of the envelope analysis from Nate Silver last night, who was thinking about what the Democratic Party is actually made up of right now. And he says, roughly speaking, it's about a third people who are liberal progressive types. It's about a third people who are in the Hillary Clinton camp, this kind of neo-democratic, more corporate democratic establishment folks. And then there's voters of color. And if you get two of those groups, you will win a primary. Now, I don't know what that says about the Democratic Party going into November or about the enthusiasm for the Democratic Party, but that sounds like about the right mix.
Right. I think, first of all, summer primaries, and I would call this a summer primary just in the sense that all of the campaigning was done in the summer leading
still
up.
Still technically summer.
It's still technically summer. You're going to have smaller turnouts, and passion is going to be a bigger factor, right? If you can generate passion in one or two of those spaces in a smaller turnout situation like that, you're going to do very well. Now what's happening is a process of kind of tuning in, right? A lot of people who didn't pay that much attention, whether we're talking Connecticut or anywhere else, didn't pay that much attention, are starting to tune in and ask questions and learn more about the candidates. Christine's article made me think about how this might affect the gubernatorial race. I would, by the way, agree that it's way too early to have a lot of trust in polls. We said this last week. The Q poll is a great poll, but I want to see two or three Q polls so I can connect data points and see what the trend lines are. But one thing that it flagged, at least initially, is a little bit of a gender gap between Stefanowski and Lamont. Now, if that's true, one of the people quoted in Christine's article said, this doesn't just affect who runs for office. It also affects who votes in elections. If, in fact, Lamont were to maintain a large lead among women, a 10% or so margin among women, and a lot more women vote than usual, that's the kind of thing that maybe, shows up in the November results.
Yeah, Christine, talk more about that, because your piece is about a record number of female candidates running for office. But to Colin's point, that also means just more female engagement, and it means more when you see numbers like that gender gap.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is supposed to be the year of the woman. So, you know, I think that more women are involved, more women are aware of pocketbook issues. They're, you know, the ones who are in charge of the family budgets, and they're also paying attention to a lot of these issues. So Quelf put out this voter guide, and these issues involve economic security for women. Connecticut is surrounded by states that have not that have passed paid family medical leave. That's something that Connecticut has been trying to pass for the past few years, but has not. You know, we were able to get pay equity over the finish line this year. Sexual harassment. We were unable to get a sexual harassment bill over the finish line because there were issues regarding the statute of limitations for sexual assault victims. But I think that women voters really played a part in 2014 in giving Dan Malloy his, you know, margin of victory over Republican Tom Foley. And they sent Linda McMahon packing, too. You know, there was a gender gap in that race, and women were the ones who denied her a U.S. Senate seat.
I just want to quickly say that Quelf is the Connecticut Women's Education and yes. Legal Fund for people who don't know what that is. And just very quickly,
who doesn't know what
Quelf is? But let me just follow up, Christine. Though it's interesting, women in charge of the household income, the household budget, and the way that they may view the issues. Quite substantially different than men. They're looking for different things from their government officials potentially than men who might just be looking, as Bob Stefanowski is banking on, at how much taxes they're paying to the state or to the federal government.
Right. I think that I'm probably a little bit hyper aware because I am a woman and I am a working woman and I am a woman who is also a mother.
And you run your own business.
And I run my own business. That there are substantial challenges that I face on a daily basis. And I think that we're beginning to have a conversation about those challenges. And I think, there are some pieces out there recently regarding the challenges of being a working mother and trying to have it all. And that is really impossible in this day and age. And there's a lot of barriers to being able to be successful. And I think we saw that also with the Alice report this week from the United Way, and that 40% of Connecticut is unable to meet a basic household survival budget.
We're going to loop back to that a little bit later when we talk about the state minimum wage. But I want to ask you about this too, Paz, about this movement, the Year of the Woman, and what exactly that means in terms of local and state politics. What do you think it means at the national level as well?
Well, there's been a gender gap for several cycles now that women have been trending Democratic, and women tend to turn out. You know, the data is not overwhelming, but women tend to turn out in larger numbers than men. So that's why people like us pay attention, more attention sometimes to the female gender gap and what it means. Another aspect of that is how the president ranks among women. There is a difference. How the president demeans and attacks people on Twitter. Generally, you know, again, you have to be careful. You know, when you talk about suburban women voters or soccer moms was in vogue years ago. But in any event, there's certainly polling data that shows that does not play particularly well among female voters. So I think you have a whole bunch of things coming together. You know, Colin mentioned Indy Fleischman, who was a 20-year state rep from West Hartford. And he was defeated at primary by a woman, Jillian Gilchrist, who had been involved in, you know, organizing locally on the Women's March and things like that. And so you do have this sense things are coming together. Now, anecdotally, I've had Republicans, fairly prominent Republicans, tell me that they keep encountering women, Republican women, who are really turned off by the president, and they are fearful as to what that will mean at the polls.
As well they perhaps should be, Colin. I think it's not for nothing that what happened yesterday is a continuation of what we've seen throughout the course of the summer in this primary season. But it's also happening in a week that has been kind of a bad week for Donald Trump. I mean, you have Brett Kavanaugh and these confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill starting today, having to answer a whole lot of questions about his views on abortion and his views on guns, not to mention what he thinks about the power of the presidency. And you have this Bob Woodward book coming out and, you know, NPR leading one of its segments talking about the allegations there. The Trump White House pushing back against the book, but maybe not in the same forceful way that they might about others writing books because, you know, it's Bob Woodward. He probably didn't make up stuff in the book. I don't know if that's a big piece of this, too, is that there is all of this stuff coming together at the same time. You have compelling candidates while there's this national fervor where a lot of women on both sides of the political spectrum might just be sick of the way things are working.
Right. Well, I mean, first of all, the ABC Washington Post poll really does indicate that some of those women who really helped Donald Trump achieve his surprising margins, and I mean, I think it was not expected that he would do particularly well with any groups of women, but a lot of that women's support seems to be sagging badly. That's where he's losing ground in both the strongly approve and just flat out approve categories. You know, I guess what I would say about this week is this week. And one thing that we've learned since January of 2017 and maybe even earlier is that one thing tends to kind of drive out another. So there's a cumulative effect to all these stories. But I guarantee you that within, you know, 8 to 10 days, we won't be talking about the Woodward book, which actually comes out on September 11th. But you will be talking about something else. People have already forgotten that the Michael Wolff book that came out, I think, in January, said all of the same stuff, apparently, that the Woodward book says. But it's the cumulative effect. And sometimes it's also these little moments. I mean, you know, you mentioned all this Kavanaugh stuff. I guess we don't really know exactly what happened when the Parkland parent tried to talk to him. It seemed as though he kind of whirled away from that person. You know, little moments like that also that where your nominee seems to lack empathy or, you know, want to cut off contact with somebody, maybe who's still in quite a bit of pain, that might not play very well with women or with anybody for that matter. But the one danger is thinking that this week contains some kind of finite content that will stay in people's minds past the next set of outrages. They just keep coming and coming.
Yeah, but we've already forgotten what you started saying just a few minutes ago, Colin.
I've forgotten what I started saying.
That's how quickly the news cycles move. We're talking today with Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on Connecticut Public Radio, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. When we come back, we're going to preview the first debate of the general election season in the governor's race, which is coming up tonight. It doesn't actually have the Republican as part of that, but there's still a lot to talk about in the governor's race here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation about the week's news at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us today is Christine Stewart, editor-in-chief of CTNewsJunkie.com, Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, and also Colin McEnroe, who hosts the Colin McEnroe Show. What's on your show today, Colin?
Well, John, if you'd called me or if I'd known that you had called me, you'd know that I'm doing a show about the Nike arrangements with Colin Kaepernick. We have some really interesting guests about this who will look at it. First of all, is it a successful advertising strategy for Nike? And obviously, we'll also look at the cultural implications of Kaepernick kind of reemerging now as a guy with some new and very different visibility.
So that's this afternoon on the Colin McEnroe Show. I will tell you that our program, which usually is rebroadcast at 7 o'clock each night, will not be rebroadcast tonight because instead we will be taking live coverage of the first gubernatorial debate of the general election season here at Connecticut Public Radio. We're taking part in this with our friends at the Connecticut Mirror, WFSB-TV, and also the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges. It's over at the University of St. Joseph, and it includes, well, one of the candidates who we knew was going to be here, Ned Lamont. He's the Democratic nominee. Another one of the candidates who had hoped to be part of a lot of these debates, Oz Griebel, who is running an unaffiliated, I suppose, campaign. He's a petitioning candidate, and he's on the ballot. The third guy, well, he's not going to be there, Bob Stefanowski. Here's Bob Stefanowski talking with our friend Max Reese from NBC Connecticut. He spent a lot of time, he says, securing the independent party's endorsement. He's sitting out this particular debate, and he's trying to get his general election campaign off and running. Here's Bob.
Lamont's been running with Susan for a while. I had a five-person primary, so we're up and running. We've hired some people. We got the independent vote. I'm very, very happy with the last couple of weeks, and you're going to see more of us coming out after Labor Day.
Okay, so how much of Bob Stefanowski have we seen, Paz?
Well, he only recently started publishing his schedule. I think I used the phrase going dark at one point, and Jack Fowler from the National Review, you know, went off on me on Twitter saying, no, he was at the Milford Oyster Festival campaigning aggressively. You know, well, fine. He's been out doing little things, but he is retooling. He needs money. He needed more staff. He's reached out and hired more staff. And he also has a lot of internal work to do with the Republican Party. Stefanowski is absolutely right when he said, you know, Lamont's been the presumptive nominee for quite a while for the Democrats. He and Susan have been running as a team.
Susan Bisewitz?
Yes, Susan Bisewitz has been running as a team. So Stefanowski does have a lot to do, and we can get to it, but certainly money's going to be part of it.
Well, let's just stop there because sure. I think a lot of people hear you, and we've said this before in the show, say that Bob Stefanowski needs money. He doesn't have money. And part of the story going into his campaign was he's one of these wealthy businessmen who's going to be self-funding. He's not going to take part in the citizens' election. Why does he need money? Why does he need money? I thought he'd just bankroll this himself.
Well, look, I don't have access to his personal balance sheets, but it's pretty clear that he does not have Ned Lamont money. He does not have David Stemmerman money. Ironically enough, among the five Republicans in the primary, he was the only guy that Republicans were nervous about his ability to compete financially. Because, yes, he did put in $2.3 million, and you have to say, he spent it very smartly. He had a good team. It was a small team. They spent money early on TV, and they had an impressive victory. In a five-way race, to have almost 30% is pretty damn good. But now he's got to pivot. And the question, you know, the three candidates who were publicly financed, if any of those had won, the next day they would have been handed a check for $6.5 million in public financing. David Stemmerman clearly had more money. In fact, he had about $6.5 million in his campaign account ready to go. Stefanowski ended the primary campaign with almost no money left in his campaign account. Now, what we don't know is how much of his personal funds can he quickly put in. We won't see another campaign finance report from him until October 10th.
And I want to get back to where the money's coming from the Stefanowski campaign and for this governor's race. But I think, Christine, to another part of what Paz is talking about, rebuilding relationships within the Republican Party. Of course, he sat out the entire convention process. He didn't take part in a lot of the debates. He won by putting a lot of money into ads and getting his name out there in front of a lot of the other Republican candidates, but not exactly playing nice with the party.
So this is why the convention process exists. So Bob Stefanowski did not go to the convention. He petitioned his way onto the primary ballot. And, you know, instead at the convention, which was at the casino, he had a hospitality room in which he had an open bar and he had some food. And I think it was something he spent like something like $11,000 on wining and dining these Republican delegates. And so there was an expectation that went along with that, that this guy must have money to be able to finance his own campaign.
He's going to show up and he's going to give me like treats.
But the thing is, like, right. And the reason, well, I mean, that's the reason why the convention process exists, I guess. I am sure that there's going to be people who differ with me. But I believe that in order to be able to vet candidates and find out, you know, how deep are your pockets and what are you willing to do and where are you willing to go with this? And I think that Tom Foley had learned that lesson between 2010 and 2014. And the second time he ran, he used public financing because right now Bob Stefanowski is on the phone making calls for money when he's not able at that time to talk to voters.
And to Christine's point, I mean, I interviewed Tom Foley for a story I had Tuesday on that very point because in 2010, he put in $11 million of his own money. He raised $1.6 million. So I kind of use that as a test case of how difficult it is for these guys. Because you got to remember, Tom Foley was as wired as anybody into the Republican fundraising network, and the best he could do was $1.6 million. And a Republican operative said, well, you better check with him to see if whether or not he just decided it wasn't worth his time. He told me, oh, yes. He tried very hard to raise money. And he made the point, which is a fairly obvious point, that once you're writing your own checks to your own campaign and people think you're covered, mm-hmm. there's this natural reluctance to then write checks for $2,500 or $3,500, which is the maximum now. And Ned Lamont in 2006, he started out as kind of a Howard Dean grassroots guy. He had a ton of money coming in from across the country for his Senate race in small denominations until he wrote his first big check for $500,000. And then that all stopped because, you know, the liberal activist in Oregon who was sent him $50 said, well, hell, this guy doesn't need it.
I could spend that money better myself, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, I think for Stefanowski, there's a danger that if he gets too bogged down in the process that Christine and Paz are describing, I mean, he has to solve this problem. He's got to have money. He's got to be able to put commercials on the air. But he's got a much bigger job. You know, you have to sort of think about what he's got to do. He's got two main goals, right? One of them is to keep Republican turnout as high as possible. So he's got to be an appealing enough Republican so that the relatively small group of registered Republican voters in this state turn out in droves for him, that they feel emotion and they're motivated. And then he's got to have a message and a personality that appeals to that much larger group of unaffiliated voters, most of whom probably have not tuned into him very much. You know, I mean, the people watching all those commercials on Fox News were probably more Republicans than unaffiliated voters. He's got to figure out, you know, what kind of message and identity is going to work with this unaffiliated group. And I think there he faces some risks. It may have something to do with why he's not at the first debate. I think he's a guy right now because he's not really a particularly experienced politician. When he talks off the cuff, he occasionally, I think, will say stuff that sort of puts him a little bit out towards the edges of even mainstream conservative thought. And if he's going to go after those unaffiliated voters, he's got to find a message that's true to him but also works for them.
Well, I think that that's the risk. He didn't have a rich background in Connecticut politics, and so he doesn't have a lot of staff that is from Connecticut. A lot of the staff is from outside of Connecticut. They're trying to figure out, you know, where Bob is on some of these issues and how we need to message that in strategy. And then you have all these operatives from Connecticut who are Republicans who are trying to offer help, and they can't prioritize it either because they don't trust them or they just don't know Connecticut well enough.
Paz, I want to ask you before we get off of Bob Stefanowski and turn to this debate that we're going to have tonight with Oz Griebel and Ned Lamont. Where is he getting some of his money from, though? Because we've said already that the national Republicans are targeting this race. They are thinking about how much money they're going to spend in this. But there's also a Stefanowski super PAC out there, and it's being funded by some interesting people.
Yes. So you get money two ways, or really three ways. The hardest thing is the hard dollars, the direct contributions to a campaign. Under Connecticut law, you're limited to maximum contributions of $3,500. If you gave Bob $3,500 in the primary, you can max out again in the general $3,500. But, you know, he raised about $300,000 by people who had maxed out in the primary, so he can go back to them. But again, another $300,000 is really not much. So it takes a lot of time to raise money directly, and he's really behind the eight ball on that. The other way you could raise money is you can direct your wealthier friends to give to the state party. They can write checks for $10,000. And Tom Foley, in fact, in 2014, when he was publicly financed, he told all his old donors, send your money to the state Republican Party, and they raised between $2 and $3 million based on Tom's outreach. Now you have the third and newer and potentially more important way, which is super PACs. Now, new this year, we saw early on super PACs dedicated to a particular candidate, as opposed to previous cycles where super PACs came in after a nominee was chosen. And the Democrats would have one, the Republicans would have one. This year, there's a super PAC dedicated just to Bob Stefanowski. And one of its donors is a guy in Greenwich named Reverge, excuse me if I'm mispronouncing his first name, Anselmo. His father was very successful, established a network of private satellites. This guy has contributed $1.4 million to the Bob Stefanowski super PAC, which is called Protect Freedom. There's also another super PAC, which is funded primarily by the Republican Governors Association so far. They've put up $1 million. And if you watch television, you will see ads kicking the crap out of Ned Lamont right now. And those are the Republican Governors Association ads. So those are the three kind of pots of money.
And again, this is the pot of money that you can't coordinate your campaign with, but it's clear what they're trying to do.
You can coordinate with the state parties.
Of course.
You cannot coordinate, obviously, with the super PACs. The U.S. Supreme Court, in its wisdom, has said that direct contributions to a campaign are corrupting, so states can limit them. So it's corrupting to give, you know, $8,000 to Bob Stefanowski directly, but it's not corrupting to spend $1.4 million to run ads in his behalf.
I know, Colin, you were more interested in Reverge Anselmo because of his film Stateside, an autobiographical love story that took place in his teen years, which was actually part of a larger film bio that he has. But I suppose you could also talk about the super PAC.
Yeah, I mean, this may be, I mean, the sort of the solution to the problem that we sort of started this whole conversation talking about, right? I mean, at a certain point, Stefanowski needs to get off the phone and figure out how to campaign. He can't be raising money forever. This kind of thing may help a lot. It's sort of, you know, once again, it sort of raises questions about the success of this is a citizen election program and limiting this kind of thing. It's not their fault. It's really the result of Citizens United. That's the reason that you really can't keep this kind of money out. But it's kind of too bad, too.
Christine, I want to move to this debate that's happening tonight. It's taking place, as we said, at the University of St. Joseph. It'll be broadcast here on Connecticut Public Radio starting at 7 o'clock. We'll be asking questions of Ned Lamont, the Democrat in the race, and Oz Griebel, who has successfully petitioned onto the ballot. He's also trying to petition his way into more debates like this, somewhat so far unsuccessfully.
Yeah, so he's been trying to get into the September 12th and the September 17th debate. One is sponsored by The Day and WTNH, and the other is WTNH and the Connecticut Realtors. So the common denominator being WTNH, which is setting the criteria for the race, which requires candidates to receive at least 10% of support in any nonpartisan professional poll.
And again, this isn't coming from the local folks at WTNH, your local Channel
right.
8. It's coming from Texas-based parent company Nexstar Broadcasting. So essentially, they're saying, here's what our qualifying rules are to get into one of our debates.
Right. And so the only poll that has been out, which they were in the field the day after the primaries, was the Quinnipiac University poll, in which Oz received 4%. So he is not being included in these debates because of that. So even though he will be on the ballot, he will not be in these debates.
Paz, I'll ask you first. I'd like to hear Colin on this as well. But how much does it matter? I mean, so we've got probably a total of 6 debates planned, I think. The one that is happening tonight is one of them. Bob Stefanowski is not going to be there. Oz Griebel will be there. Oz probably won't be on the stage for many, if any, of the other debates. How much do these debates really matter in the end? We love them, but...
Well, for somebody like Oz Griebel, they can matter a lot because, you know, Griebel has had, you know, he had a budget of like $225,000 leading up to this. He has not been able to go on TV. He's certainly known in journalistic circles because of his leadership of the Metro Hartford Alliance for many years and the fact he was a Republican candidate for governor in 2010. So he is very much a mainstream political figure, and that puts Oz in his own little category because some of the folks who petition the way on, you know, nobody's ever heard of before. Some of them can be a little eccentric, to be generous. No names. And so, yeah, I think for Oz, that's why he's, that's why he's fighting so hard to get in because he does not have the budget to be on TV. In the general scheme of things, that's always a great point. How influential are debates? The candidates certainly take them carefully. I mean, Bob Stefanowski, part of this is he's doing debate prep now. And I think his people decided for a one-on-one debate, September 12th is better than September 5th. He skipped a lot of the Republican debates. He participated at the end. He did fine. But it's a different dynamic when you get 5 people on the stage and it's easier to play defense. It's easier to stick to one single message, which he did over and over and over again, which is Connecticut's taxes and the economy. And he would just say, I'm going to stay laser focused, which allowed him to avoid other issues. In a general election, you can't do that. People have all kinds of interest. They want to know your position on all kinds of things. One of the ironies about tonight's debate is the focus is on the economy. And, you know, this theoretically went to, you know, went to his wheelhouse, but he still declined to to go.
Right. So just to go back to that original Q poll, it was such a disaster for Oz Griebel, right? I mean, Oz Griebel has been running a campaign. You know, he doesn't have very much money, but he's been running a campaign for quite some time. He had a convention. He and Monty Frank, his running mate, had a convention. You know, so to get 4%, which is like what a big potato would get, you know, it was horrible. It really was sort of probably the minimal showing that somebody of his stature could possibly have imagined getting. And there's sort of big consequences for that, including this, you know, this rule that exists on a national level about that one particular debate. I think it's good if Oz is in the debates. You know, I think he can maybe transform these debates from just sort of sniping back and forth, well, you said this, I said this, to maybe a little bit more issue focused. Usually having a third person in there, as long as it's not H. Ross Perot, has that effect on a debate. But Paz is also right. Okay, I will name names. So Mark Stewart Greenstein, who I actually know and find to be very good company, but who possibly could wear the label eccentric, is very close to getting enough signatures to have enough signatures qualified to be on the ballot. He's very close. He would not perform in a debate quite the same way that Oz Griebel would. And I could sort of understand why debate organizers, whether they had a rule, you know, about poll numbers or not, you know, might not see that as something that they particularly wanted. And as Paz said, we know Oz. We know how he's different. We've known him for many years and many cycles. But who cares? Who cares what we think? We're, you know, journalism snobs.
Well, I think that he would have done better in the Quinnipiac University poll if it hadn't been in the, you know, in the field immediately after the primaries, right, in which, you know, all of that was on TV were Democratic and Republican candidates.
I think that that's right. Yeah.
And, you know, and I know this is frustrating for third-party candidates, minor candidates, but you know there are two metrics to use. One is money, and the other one is polling. And you don't get good polling without money. And it's hard to get money if you don't have some standing in the polls. So I get it. That is, but in defense of debate organizers, whether it's TNH or anybody else, you want some screen to have a reasonable mm-hmm. debate. You know, Florida, for example, it's like a presidential commission where they have very hard, you know, I think it's like 12.5%, 13.5%. The states that have wide open ballot access tend to be much stricter. They have much more experience than Connecticut does, because you can otherwise would have a dozen candidates maybe on the stage for a primary, for example. So, I mean, it's a hard thing. In the case of the debate we are involved with, we were, I guess, fortunate from a journalistic point of view that we weren't in the position of having to be the gatekeeper, that the underlying sponsor, the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges, said, well, okay, Oz had made the ballot. There's three who are on the ballot. They're all people of certain standing. We will invite them all.
Well, should the media be in charge of saying who's in these debates? I mean, if you are on the ballot and voters are going to see your name in November when they go into the voting booth, you know, should the media have any say at all as to you know, what criteria should be set forward for these debates?
I think that's a great point. I think it's a really good question. And look, I mean, you know, we all remember the Senate debate that had Lee Whitnum and Matthew Oakes. And I mean, that certainly had a memorable moment in it. Was it a terrible debate because those people were up there? As you say, if they're on the ballot, why can't they debate?
Well, could there be an independent commission? Could there be some way for the states to run these debates that it's not coming just through these media companies? Because trust me, I've been part of years worth of trying to put together these debates, and it's not easy, folks. It's not easy to get people to commit. It's not easy to work with all the other partners and all the other things that you have to do. And so it's nice tonight that we have a debate. I will say quickly that while Mark Stewart Greenstein may well qualify by today, because today is the deadline for all the counting to be done, we may hear that he is on the ballot. Rod Hanscom, who is a libertarian, has already qualified to be on the ballot. He's somebody I met, and many people I think met for the first time at an environmental forum that we held earlier this year at Trinity College. He is a heating and cooling contractor, so he actually knew an awful lot about the issue there, sort of a traditional libertarian candidate who's also going to be on the ballot, not part of tonight's debate because he had not qualified previously when we made the offers to come to tonight's debate. When we come back from a break, we're going to talk about one other issue that we didn't get to that is probably going to come up tonight, the minimum wage, and also going to talk about a couple sports stories if we have any time here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking with Mark Pazniokas of the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe from Connecticut Public Radio, and also Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. With a quick correction of me, Christine, let's just talk about this. What's the deadline today? So today I had said that we needed to know whether or not Mark Stewart Greenstein had all the signatures in to actually get on the ballot, but you're saying that's not right, right?
That's not right. Today is the deadline for the minor party candidates to or the minor parties to submit their candidates
so
for the ballot.
If there were minor parties like the Independent Party or
yes.
the Working Families Party, which have already made endorsements in this race, if there were others, today is the deadline for that. So how long do we have until we know if Mark Stewart Greenstein has gotten 7,500 signatures?
Until they finish counting, I guess. So until all the mail is returned to the Secretary of State's office. Then we will know. There's no hard and fast deadline on
that.
Well,
there was a hard deadline for them to get the petitions in, and then it gets very soft about what happens after that.
Okay, so hard deadlines, soft deadlines. Here's an important issue that is probably going to come up in all of these debates. What do we do with the minimum wage? Ned Lamont has said he wants to bump up the minimum wage to $15 an hour. This is something that's been talked about amongst progressive circles for quite some time. It's taken hold in different parts around the country. Bob Stefanowski's response to this, Colin, a little curious because I don't think he was saying he doesn't support a $15 an hour minimum wage. He seemed to suggest he didn't support a minimum wage.
Right. That was his first comment. And then it seemed as though maybe with the next puff of breath, he kind of slightly revised this. But the first thing that he said was philosophically, he doesn't believe in the minimum wage at all. He thinks that it should be dictated by market forces. You know, that's not a completely – it's not a completely fringe theory. There are lots of people out there in America who think that. But within the political discourse, the notion of not believing in a minimum wage, it does sort of kick you into a slightly different category. And I think it's – I mean, if it became a pattern with Stefanowski, and I think you could even sort of say like putting Arthur Laffer in your commercials. Arthur Laffer is an economist associated with Reagan.
He likes to talk about this. Yeah.
There are ways in which Stefanowski, I think, hasn't successfully identified what the mainstream is. I mean, what the Overton window for even talking about economics might be. I sort of think that's a thing you don't say. I don't believe in the minimum wage at all.
Linda, that was that may have been the beginning of the end for Linda McMahon her first time. So Linda McMahon was endorsed by the National Federation of Independent Businesses her first run. And actually, I mean, I recall well the moment because I'm the one who asked the question. And it was not a gotcha question, but, you know, I said the NFIB stands for certain things. They don't want a federal minimum wage. They don't like the Americans with Disabilities Act. So how much of this agenda have you signed on to? And Linda McMahon sort of hedged, and she initially made it sound like she didn't believe in a federal minimum wage. And the reporters chased her out into the parking lot. And we wouldn't let her go until we sort of got her to clarify. And no, in fact, she believes in the federal minimum wage, and it was a question of what the state minimum wage should be raised to. But, you know, the AFL-CIO, the Democrats, they use that like a cudgel over and over and over again and say, okay, this rich lady doesn't think, you know, we need a minimum wage.
Well, and maybe it's not, Christine, about what a rich guy or rich lady think about the minimum wage. Maybe it's about what voters think. So Q poll question on the minimum wage. Voters say 63 to 33%. They support raising the state minimum wage from $10.10 an hour to $15 an hour. And that comes out alongside other reports from the United Way and others that show just how desperate a lot of households are to have a living wage of any sort.
Yeah, and I don't think that the minimum wage is even close to a living wage. So, you know, I think that there has been attempts over the past few years to increase our $10.10 minimum wage right now to there was an attempt to raise it up to $12 because it depended on what Senator Joan Hartley was going to agree to or not. You know, I think that they might. You know, they're obviously going to try again this year, but it will depend on what the makeup is of the General Assembly and obviously who's governor. If Bob Stefanowski doesn't support a minimum wage, it's unlikely he'd sign legislation.
But if that many people in the state support it, Colin, it seems to suggest that there's more support than just from people who might benefit directly, personally, from that higher minimum wage.
Right. And I would imagine that you're going to see commercials from the Ned Lamont campaign. If I were making making a commercial right now, I would maybe even do it as kind of a little skit where some employer goes, well, would you take $6 an hour because you really need this job, right? You know, and if you're really good after a year, I'll bump you up to $7. I think he wrong-footed this question, and I'm sure people have gotten to him since then and said, that's not how you answer that question. But as Paz suggests in the case of Linda McMahon, when you wrong-foot something like that and it gets on the record, sometimes it's very, very difficult to revise your position because they've already got it and they can beat you up with it.
There's ads with Ned Lamont talking about raising taxes because he said something a certain way, and that does stick with you.
Yes, right. Ned Lamont has his own issues about speaking off the cuff, so let's be clear there.
Fair is fair.
That is true.
When you raise taxes, you know, when an FM disc jockey can maneuver you to that point, that's not a good thing.
Don't disparage FM disc jockeys.
No, sir. But so the minimum wage is a weird issue. It's a weird issue. It was a weird issue for Linda McMahon to trip over. First off, the federal minimum wage, because it's irrelevant in Connecticut, because yes. Connecticut's at so much higher. And in Connecticut, historically, at different times, it actually has been a bipartisan issue. But it hasn't been for a number of years because Connecticut's economy has been so awful. And the Republicans have taken the position that even if statistically it doesn't hurt the economy, it's a bad image. It goes to how competitive Connecticut is with other states. Now, Connecticut's in a position where at one point it was leading the pack in New England. It no longer is. So the legislators in the middle of the road, they do get more comfortable with a higher minimum wage when the surrounding states are a little bit higher and you are not the outlier at any point.
We've got a Pantera hit sweep coming up right now, so.
Q103.3. I just want to take a quick break. We've got just a minute left, Colin. I want to give you the last word on something entirely different. We're sort of marking this week two things. The end of the Hartford Yard Goat season and the beginning of the UConn Huskies football season. Basically, here's how it went. A lot of us said the Yard Goats, probably a bad idea in terms of the way they were going to build the baseball stadium, stealing a team from down the street in New Britain. Maybe this isn't the best public policy. That seems to be going very, very well, setting attendance records 2 years in a row. People seem to love the Yard Goats. On the other hand, we got a stadium, Rentschler Field. It has fewer people sitting in it than really ever before since UConn football started down the street in Rentschler Field, and the Huskies just got blown out in their season opener. What can we say about these two sports things?
Well, I think I can actually link them together a little bit. I mean, there's a sort of a shoot the wounded and declare victory philosophy to this whole phenomenon, which is, you know, I mean, what they do is they set up parameters for success in the course of getting public money to build stadiums. And then when the things don't perform that way, they change the parameters. So, I mean, I don't want to be a skunk at the garden party about the Yard Goats. I know people like the Yard Goats. They're selling out. That's great. I'm happy that's happening. But the original parameters were things like creation of 1,000 jobs. That really hasn't happened. And private investment in this, you know, $350 million no-do development. That hasn't happened. Really, you know, there were all sorts of stuff about people going to be booking hotel rooms. I mean, you know, that stuff hasn't happened. The idea that this $71 million stadium was going to leverage private money for Hartford, I don't really see that happening. So, yeah, we're already – so we changed the parameters. The parameters are now, are we happy about it? Does it make people feel good about Hartford? You know, and that's a pretty expensive emotional hit, that $71 million. Hartford's still losing money on the books every year from this stadium.
But it's nowhere near as expensive overall as the cost of UConn being in Division I football.
No, and you know they had 58% capacity for their blowout loss to open the season. So that's a whole other story.
You know, Andrew Zimbalist, the Cassandra of sports stadiums when it comes to economics. I mean, he's the guy who always is used to say these are stupid financially. He is the consultant in Worcester that they use to make the case for building a minor league. It's far more expensive.
The $100 million.
And let me just say, we're going to be talking about this on Next coming up this week. Yeah, once again, spending a lot of money up in Massachusetts to bring in other things from Rhode Island, the Paw Sox, from Connecticut, General Electric. We'll see how it turns out. Mark Pazniokas will be with me tonight asking questions of the candidates as part of a debate. He's from the Connecticut Mirror. Thank you, Paz.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Christine Stewart from CTNewsJunkie.com. Thank you, Christine.
Thanks, John.
And thanks to our own Colin McEnroe. The Wheelhouse is produced by Scott Breedy. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer, and the technical producer is Kion Wolf. Thanks for joining us.